5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Testing. 1, 2, 3. Testing.
Well, I'm not really going to speak. I'm just going to deliver myself of a few sort of remarks from the podium that I get to make, and then introduce our speakers for this evening. As you know, those of you who were here last week, we began a discussion of women as educators in the state of Minnesota. And at that time, we talked particularly about those who came as elementary school teachers, high school teachers to the state of Minnesota. And we talked a little bit about the kinds of restrictions that were placed upon them and the kind of double standard that prevailed between men teachers and women teachers, and a little bit about the invisibility of women in the official view, whereas in fact women were by far the vast majority in the classrooms of the state of Minnesota. This evening we're going to discuss the role of women both historically and at the present time in higher education in this state. And as we do so, that introduces, I think, another whole set of issues into the question of the relationship between women and education. As long as women were teaching little children, teaching could be seen as a kind of extension of the mothering function, an extension of the nurturing function. But when you begin to talk about women in higher education, either as students or teachers, you begin to move away from the assumptions about teaching as something that women do best because women are best at nurturing little children. And in the 19th century, in addition to the assumption that women's place was in the home as mothers, or if not in the home, at least acting as kind of substitute mothers. In addition to that really ideology, you have another set of ideas about the general mental weakness of women. During the 19th century, particularly late in the century, you began to get the elaboration of a great many ideas about women being subject to brain fever if they had to submit to the strain of thought. And the concern about a mental breakdown if they taxed their brains. Some actually believed that women students, if they studied too hard and learned too much, their brains would expand and crack their skulls. So the whole thing was regarded as a very perilous endeavor. But in spite of that, we do have, by the end of the 19th century, a number of very distinguished women in this state who served as educators in higher education, and really a great variety of them. And so we're going to begin this evening by talking about some of those individual educators, Mariah Sanford, Ada Comstock, Mother Antonia McHugh. And our speakers for this evening are Jerry Schofield, Sister Karen Kennelly, Susan Smith, whom you met last week, and Virginia Lanigren. And I think I will, instead of popping up and introducing each one separately, I will just say we'll go down the line in order. So Jerry, would you like to begin? Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Good evening. 95 years ago this autumn, very autumn, Mariah Louise Sanford arrived in Minneapolis from the East to join the faculty of the University of Minnesota. Her salary was $1,200 a year at a time when men were being hired for $1,500. She was hired as an assistant professor to teach history, rhetoric, and elocution. But before the year was up, the dynamic Miss Sanford was the chairman of the rhetoric and the elocution department. In her second year, she was promoted to a full professorship and managed to remain there for 27 years. And it is of these years of which I wish to speak tonight, for often they were tumultuous, and her hold upon rank and title was occasionally tenuous indeed. Ms. Sanford emphasized morality, social service, the love of beauty and art and literature, and exemplified the Puritan work ethic to the hundreds of students who attended her classes over the years. As a public speaker, she brought stimulation by her magic lantern illustrated lectures to farm wives, to working women, and dozens of groups outside the academic world. Over the years, she became a cult figure, venerated by generations of women who thought of her as representative of them. But there were many ways in which the zealous and passionate Mariah differed. One way was the very drama of her life, for she'd lived a full life before she even set foot on Minnesota soil. She was 43 years old, and she taught school for 24 years, with teaching in all levels of instruction behind her. When President Falwell hired her, her fortunes were at a low ebb, for she was out of work, she was in debt, and she was quite possibly still in love with a married man. And the man in particular, his name was Edward Hicks McGill, and he was the president of Swarthmore College, where she'd served in his history department for 10 years, where she was one of the first women college professors in America. She had to leave for several reasons. The most important, perhaps, was the faculty dissatisfaction over her trying to juggle two careers, that of a successful public speaker off campus with her on-campus work as a brilliant teacher. In order to placate his faculty, the president had reluctantly to cut her salary from $2,400 to $1,500. But a few jealous faculty members continued to harass her, although none could know the personal suffering that she was undergoing, because neither she nor the president, because of their moral code, could continue the anguish much longer, and because of her being in debt, for she was always contributing to the support of less fortunate relatives then and after she came to Minnesota. For three reasons then: money, sort of a love affair, and a faculty who felt that she was overstepping her bounds, she left. Another way in which she differed from those women in Minnesota who venerated her so much was her Yankee heritage, for she was literally a granddaughter of the American Revolution. Both of her grandfathers on both sides had served in the army against the British. Her family, in fact, had settled Old Saybrook, Connecticut. She attended the Congregational Church with its Puritan overtones, and she'd been reared in the public schools in Meriden, Connecticut. Her father was always burdened with debt, due perhaps to an unsuccessful business venture in which he'd lost a great deal of money in Georgia. He struggled and paid off all this money, and so it was a hardship in a way for him to give her her dowry money early in order for her to go to New Britain Normal School. Now that is all the education she had, really, was New Britain Normal School or college, perhaps school would be a better term, in Connecticut. She graduated at 19 with honors, but her first teaching job for $10 a month, 40 miles away in case she failed so that her parents wouldn't suffer, she got $10 a month, and she was so anguished and so concerned that she said, if it were not for the sin of suicide on my soul, I would have thrown myself into the bottom of the nearby ocean. Are any of you teachers tonight? Do you remember those years? But somehow her confidence got greater as she had successes, and successes she had. She moved from one school to another. She moved all across the state of Connecticut. Now, it would be hard to get less than $10 a month, and very quickly her salary increased until she was teaching in Pennsylvania, and she became a principal of a school and a high school at that. In fact, she was even urged to run for county superintendent of schools and very nearly won, except for the fact that she was a woman. And so her success made her known to the young College of Swarthmore in Pennsylvania, Quaker School. And she was hired to teach in this college. And it was Swarthmore that she so reluctantly left to come to Minnesota. It was also President McGill, the president of Swarthmore, who arranged for her meeting with President Falwell of the University of Minnesota and who hired her. And it was also McGill whose letters and faith in her sustained her over the difficult days that were to lie ahead. This Yankee schoolmistress, now out west, charmed Minnesotans with her musical voice, with its deep timbre and almost foreign inflection. Now, her name is spelled Maria, but it was pronounced Mariah, and even that had a tang to it and a little touch of salt air. She was accompanied by a niece when she arrived in Minnesota, and she bought a house the next year, which is still standing at 1401 6th Street in Dinkytown. She filled it with 16 students, and the girls helped with the housework, and the boys did what they could, but it was Mariah who really shouldered the burden of running the house. No job was too difficult for her. She laid sod. She washed windows. She stoked the furnace. She shoveled snow. The house was her delight. And then in the evening, she would hold court at the supper table with the students, sharing her great fund of information with them. In fact, living with Mariah was lots of fun because she had parties and even dances. And it became so much fun that other students heard about it, and she had to open another house next door, 1405. Both of these houses are still standing in Dinkytown. She immediately joined the Congregational Church, which the second president of Minnesota, Cyrus Northrop, also joined when he came. And her early years at Minnesota were stimulating, and she was an active member of the university committee, community, and a builder of the name. But audiences all through her career considered her an expert in English literature, when indeed it was rhetoric and elocution that was her forte. She built many of her rhetoric classes on subjects she'd taught in Swarthmore in the history department. Her main emphasis was on the art of the ancient world, including architecture, statues, and buildings. And over the years, she built up a large collection of pictures and aided her lectures with magic lantern slides. And many students flocked to her classes because of the entertainment value of them. And for many of her rural students, this exotic world of Rome and Italy and Carthage, Egypt, stimulated their imaginations. She was also popular for her facile wit and for her lecturing in her own right. Her classes, indeed, were so full that she had to schedule them at odd hours. Her sunrise class was a great honor, for she chose only the brightest students to come every morning at 7:30. And now, maybe this scheduling was because she had overscheduled herself and had to have the 7:30 hour. But you were lucky if you weren't one of her oratorical students, because if you were giving a commencement address or were in a debate, she would meet you in her office at 4 o'clock in the morning. Letters from students who benefited from her zealous teaching shows their gratitude as they went on to become public officials, professors, librarians, informed citizens, and knowledgeable travelers. But early on, for practical purposes, she had adopted an austere black dress. It was almost like a uniform. It was homemade. It had nothing fussy. Before the days of wash and wear fabrics, I suppose that black alpaca was very, very serviceable. But she also had a pocket in it. And as late as 1916, people were shocked that Miss Sanford reached into her pocket for a handkerchief. Can you imagine? The dresses were not so practical then, but her clothes caused comment. Her skirts were long and flowing, and she adopted a much looser silhouette than the wasp waist look of that period. But more eccentric than her clothes were her office hours and her work habits. She almost lived in her office at times. She often spent Sunday afternoons there and used it as a home away from home. And sometimes she spent the night. Once she had a bad fall and ordered a mattress moved to her office. She left it only to drag herself to class. The doctor had doubted if she would ever walk again, but walk she did, and she took many a tumble on the ice, as she walked everywhere in all kinds of weather. In one such fall, she dislocated a shoulder, but she kept a speaking date. She picked up scraps of paper all over campus and put them in her pockets or carried them in her skirts to burn in her classroom fireplaces in order to save the university money. In fact, she had so many fires in her office that authorities asked her not to stay there so much. But nothing could keep her from teaching. And accounts tell of her having to be carried to class by young men when sciatica crippled her. Soon, since she lived only three blocks from campus, she was a familiar figure day and night, shuttling back and forth between the two places. She taught a course in readings, which centered around literature, including Shakespeare and the poets Lowell, Whittier, and Kipling. But she was never comfortable with novels because she didn't feel they were edifying enough, and she used poetry for instruction. According to a fellow teacher, her favorite poems were Lowell's My Love, Kipling's Mother O' Mine, and Browning's Rabbi Ben Ezra. But some students and faculty found fault with her assignments because instead of the two papers that students were supposed to write a term, she asked for one every week. But her senior literary criticism class seems extremely modern. She had subjects on current events, and the students would talk about elevating the poor, providing more cleanliness and comfort, keeping the streets in better order. They discussed the value of labor organizations and the desirability of a more equal distribution of wealth. And they even touched upon corruption in politics. Years later, Northrop referred to the work connected with her job because President Northrop had taught rhetoric at Yale. He said, and since I'm a freshman English teacher emeritus, he said, rhetorical criticism is not especially inspiring work. You can believe that. It involves much drudgery, much patience, and not a remarkably large degree of gratitude from students whose literary productions are criticized. But there were some who felt that her methods of teaching were the opposite pole of many of the other teachers because she paid little attention to the text. She was not methodical, and she did not adhere closely to any subject. She wasn't logical in her thought, but was constantly carried away by the beauty of some literary gem, which she would give her students. Those who profited by it thought of it of more value than all the textbook work. And early in her career, Ms. Sanford is credited for helping keep the land-grant college intact when the legislature threatened to separate the agricultural college from the academic campus. She acted as sort of a public relations officer, and she went out into the farm communities with a very popular speech called How to Make a Home Happy. And the secret of that was that poor homes are happy homes. And she probably found quite a few of them. She was very popular with the ladies. But in the late 1800s, Mariah saw an opportunity to invest in real estate. It was a big boom in southeast Minneapolis, and one of her students had dropped out of school and had done very well building houses. So she wrote to old-time friends in Pennsylvania and New England and told them of the investment possibilities. She hit her former superintendent of schools, W.W. Woodruff, for $8,000. And an elderly lady gave her life savings of $6,000. Mariah saw this as a way to provide retirement income for her friends and for herself, and a chance to help her family, to whom she always contributed. She borrowed from established firms and even a region in the university. She bought up sections of land around 1401, 1405, that whole block there over to 15th Avenue, and it was called Sanford Court. The boom burst, and she lost everything. Her student got out in time with a tidy profit, but her tangled web of finances is hard to penetrate as her records were scattered and unsystematic. She lost at least $30,000, and possibly more. Many business counselors advised her to go bankrupt, but as her father had done before, she insisted on repaying every penny. Ironically, she never wanted to get rich, but as it was, she never realized any profit at all. On her small salary, which each month she portioned out to creditors, she had little left for expenses. New England reticence and pride kept her from revealing the reasons for her scrimping, and few knew the tremendous burden it was for her to pay the balance and the principal for 30 years until she paid off the entire amount. In order to aid her income, now she taught three nights a week to the woman's boarding home in Minneapolis so that working girls who were flocking to the cities could enrich in their lives. She taught a refresher course to women teachers who lived there. In addition, during the year, she lectured in all winter during the evening, several nights each week, anywhere she could get an engagement, and often she would travel 50 to 100 miles, yet she never missed a class the next day. She traveled by coach, curled up on a seat, and walked directly from the railroad station to her early classes. She didn't observe the biblical injunction to keep the Sabbath, and on Sundays you found her working at home or appearing as a guest minister in Universalist, Congregational, Unitarian, or Quaker congregations wherever a vacancy would occur. Some felt that she was profiting by a system of book rentals to students. She bought art books, and each student paid $1 a year, or $1 a term, or $1 a quarter. The university switched back between terms and quarters, so that each quarter she would make X number of dollars from the rental of the books. Actually, the system was quite complicated. There were lost books. It didn't always work. But many students resented paying the fee. About this time, in 1899, they had a contest for the most popular teacher, and it was the Minneapolis Daily Journal which sponsored this. And you were to buy coupons and vote for your favorite teacher. Miss Sanford won a trip to Yellowstone. The first prize was a trip to Europe, but she didn't win it. However, her students got together, raised money, and she sent back shipboard letters, and I have never found out the name of the person who won first prize. Miss Sanford's trip was widely publicized. It's probably just as well she had the lovely trip, because the next years were poignant ones. President Cyrus Northrop, in 1900, had to write her a stern letter and told her she must not take another penny from students, that he had received so many complaints about her tutoring charges and the dollar a year book fee, and he cited disapproval both by faculty and members, but particularly for tutoring students. And about that time, a law came in effect at the university that no teacher can tutor someone who was in his own class, and that's still a rule. I could have made a killing sometimes in freshman English, but I didn't. But President Northrop wrote her 2 weeks later that the Board of Regents were considering the termination of several faculty members, including Miss Sanford, at the end of the academic year 1901. The news leaked or was leaked to the newspapers, and friends, alumni, and clubs wrote letters of protest. And as a result, none was fired. Miss Sanford, however, applied at that time, in 1900, to become the president of the University of Idaho. And she received a very lovely letter from Governor Pillsbury, and she received a letter from President McGill of Swarthmore that was sent on to Idaho saying that she was qualified for the job. And she even went out for an interview. But I don't think the time was right for a woman to be president of a university, for at least she wasn't hired. And on July the 13th, 1901, President Northrop had to write her yet another painful letter. The regents cut her salary from $2,400 a year to $1,800. And he reminded her that this was better than dismissal, but he said he regretted beyond measure the action which cannot fail to carry sorrow to all concerned. Pencil letter from Miss Sanford to Northrop told him that she objected to faculty members who criticized the way she ran her department because she had won wide reputation by her success as a teacher before some of them were out of grammar school. She wrote the Board of Regents a letter at that time in which she said that her age was mentioned as a reason for the reduction. But where can you find a woman of 35 or 40 or a man who has more vigor and endurance? And where a professor who puts in more hours of effective work? She said she carried 18 hours of recitation a week, managed her department, prepared and supervised public debates and oratorical contests. And then she wrote this, which is one of the few things that we have left that tells us her style. She said, "Under the circumstances under which I am placed, and which, when all told, would hardly be considered discreditable to me, I cannot live without such labor. Years ago, I made pledges of monthly payments, which I must keep, and I have, with my present salary, just $13 left to meet my own expenses each month. Trusting to your honor and sense of justice, I shall go on working and meeting privations cheerfully, believing that time will come when I shall have the great delight of full vindication and the complete restoration of my salary." But she could take little assurance from a letter that came from Northrop saying in 1904 that the regents are after your department anyway and will be as long as you are here. In addition to worry over her salary, she asked for salaries for her department that would retain efficient instructors and encourage those who were doing good work for small pay. Her pledge to meet privation cheerfully was tried when Old Main burned to the ground in 1904, and she lost heavily when her precious books, papers, and pictures were burned in a fire. Miss Sanford said she couldn't repress a feeling of satisfaction as she thought of the millions of cockroaches being consumed in the Holocaust. But though she could laugh wryly, she no longer had an office, and her classes were spread all over the campus until 1907, when Falwell Hall was built. In 1905, she had to give up her house, and she said the removal from her home of 24 years tore her heart by the roots. But she had to cut expenses, and she found a smaller house more than a mile further from school and moved herself into the upper three rooms. This house is at 1050 13th Avenue, and it's still standing, where she lived with two nieces and an elderly creditor. She moved her church letter to Como Church, and she had to leave the more stylish First Church, but soon she was preaching in Como Church on Sundays. Her life took an upswing December the 19th, 1906, which marked 27 years at the university and her 70th birthday. The Women's League sponsored a reception, and she received all kinds of lovely gifts, a long coat with a fur muff and a hat and roses, and they painted a portrait of her, which they put in Shevlin Hall on the site of Old Main. All the college deans and their wives were there, the governor, the Northrops. And her Sunday school class at Como Church gave her a gold watch, the only jewelry she'd ever had. But this is not to say that she wasn't debt-ridden. She still was. She practiced all sorts of economy. She raised chickens in the backyard and ordered a strain of pure-blood Plymouth Rock chickens from a Lake Crystal farmer who gave her 25% discount because he'd heard what a good lecturer she was. In order to feed her chickens, she rose before 6 in the morning and collected scraps from boarding houses near the campus and took them back, and then went back to school. She lived near the railroad yards, and she swept out empty boxcars for grain. She always carried a big basket and covered up the scraps with books so not to embarrass any male student who might ask to carry her basket. She wrote the governor, Governor Johnson, on May the 22nd, 1907, for him to intercede in behalf for her salary to be raised to $3,000. Now, if she had salary of $3,000, she could then retire on the Carnegie Pension Fund at $1,800 a year. In her letter, she said, "The lecturing which I have done in order to get the money on which to live has brought me only about $250 yearly, but it has been more wearing than all my university work." Although she was now 70, she asked for her salary to be raised to $3,000 for 5 more years. By the close of the school year 1907, her salary was increased with the stipulation that she retire in 1909 at the end of the year. But perhaps for her in her own setting, her most brilliant vindication was her selection by the senior class to deliver the 1909 commencement address. When she had first come in 1880, there were 300 students. Now there were 4,800 students. And it was perhaps the first time a woman had been asked to address a college with a commencement address. And her speech was entitled, What the University Can Do for the State. The graduating class, as I said, made her a member of the class and gave her 72 roses, one for each year of her age. And she said to her students, if but a tithe of the students who go forth each year could carry with them the determination to do something worthy and to do it with their might, what a glorious work would be done. The university catalog in 1910 did not offer the classes Miss Sanford had taught. An article in a newspaper said, it was thought that under another instructor, the special courses would not prove popular, for the number of students who flocked to her classes were attracted as much by her as by the subject matter.
By our accidental seating at the table, we've kind of reversed your program order, so I trust that won't confuse you. Those of us who study these women and wrote about them and so forth, I think are kind of overwhelmed just by meeting them and having that confrontation with their personalities and characters. And I'm sure you're going to feel like you have indigestion by the end of the night. You're going to gobble all of this up. It does strike me there are so many commonalities, even though these women are so distinctive. Could there possibly ever be anyone remotely like Mariah Sanford? But this sort of heroic stature, which you don't know is because you're looking back at them with a certain amount of nostalgia or whether they really were, you know, a truly heroic people. And then that kind of a strong moral purpose, which so many of these women seem to have had. Their education, of course, differs somewhat, but I am struck by the similarities between Mariah Sanford and the dress that was adapted by Sister Antonia McHugh for reasons other than her own personal eccentricities. I'm going to use my time just to sketch in very briefly the kind of background or context into which this woman, Annie McHugh, was her baptismal name, stepped when she became one of the early founders of the College of St. Catherine in 1905, and hence became associated with the phenomenon of colleges for women in the state of Minnesota. Almost simultaneously with that, a second college for women was begun down in Winona, Minnesota. So these two were kind of a new phenomenon in the higher education of women in the state. And then I'll settle in a little more systematically to some things about Annie McHugh's own life. The heritage or background or context into which this woman by the name of Annie McHugh came really had to do with the establishment of a school and with the appearance of a community, a group of women. And it's impossible really to think about the career of this particular woman without seeing it as a group effort. Mariah Sanford was very singular in acting alone, and this burden of debt that she tried to pay off for all these years is a great contrast to this situation in which this woman really functioned and developed a career and a remarkable role in the early history of Minnesota as a member of a group. The school that was founded was St. Joseph's Academy in what was now downtown St. Paul in November of 1851. It had its first student almost before the group arrived. The group being four Sisters of St. Joseph, as they call themselves. They had come over, three of them were French, and had come over with an original group that came to the United States to St. Louis, Missouri, actually, in 1836. So though they came up the river in response to appeals in St. Paul on the part of the then Bishop Creighton, who was trying to get anyone, Catholics, in order to start schools or teach to help in the work of establishing the state of Minnesota and the Catholic community within that state. So that was the group. Without saying anything more about it, I'm sure if you know a little bit more about sisters as a community, and others if you don't, be an interesting topic in itself. And the school that they founded was what they called an academy. This was a phenomenon of the 19th century, grew all over the country. We do have some recollections from some of the students that went to the academy in the 1860s and 1870s. One of them says this. She said that her mother's ambition was, quote, to give her daughters a good education in the finishing school sense. And she went on to say that polish or finish in her mother's judgment meant music, painting, artificial fruit and flowers, birds and worsted work, and all kinds of needlework. To this might be added a study of astronomy, that in gazing at the stars at night, we might be able to locate at least some of the constellations. So that was generally the curriculum that mothers had in mind when they sent their daughters off to these academies, and that was the type of school that really became the basis and origin for some of the higher education that later developed. As far as the community went, there are a few reflections from the period about people who did have their doubts about a religious community of women. I enjoyed this quote that appeared in the St. Paul Daily Press for September 12, 1872. They had learned that there was going to be another school founded in some part of the state, and the statement is, just as if women were not already scarce enough for wives and mothers, the Roman Catholics are building a nunnery at Detroit Lake. So it wasn't always the most popular thing. And then, of course, there came this idea of founding a college for women, the idea that they should have more education than these academies offered. And, of course, this is bringing us quite a bit closer to Annie McHugh. This brings us down to about 1891, when the Sisters of St. Joseph began to talk about extending this work in the academy into a kind of a college for women. We have a contemporary comment on that, too, and this will remind you of some of the remarks that Gretchen Kreider had to make at the beginning. I describe this as a very magnanimous gesture, and I think it kind of bespeaks a resignation to fate, if not overwhelming conviction, in which this spokesman for the people of Minnesota declared himself ready in 1891 to welcome to the state a college for young women. The times demanded it, admitted the editor of the Northwest Chronicle, published here in St. Paul. And if there remained a serious physiological question regarding the undeveloped and therefore uncomplicated state of the average woman's brain as compared with man's, still, it was best to accept the fact that the world had thrown open its doors to women. Under such circumstances, was not an educated woman to be preferred to her uneducated sister? Were not the most highly educated the freest from silly sentimentality, the most even-tempered, the most severely simple in their manner of life? The education of the future would need to help women move into the spheres of business, of literature, of science, or art so lately open to them. Accordingly, the Sisters of St. Joseph, well known throughout the Northwest for the admirable work they have done, both in connection with charitable institutions and education, were to be congratulated on their plans to introduce in St. Paul a new feature, a regular collegiate department for young women who wish to pursue the more advanced studies. End of quote. The idea really was new, although if you listening to the story about Mariah Sanford, there were, of course, women in the classes at the University of Minnesota. It is awfully hard to get numbers for those early years. But it is safe to say that possibilities for women's education beyond high school were still very limited. As far as I could figure out, during the years before this college for women began to be talked about, namely from 1869 to about 1890, the University of Minnesota began functioning with teaching classes in 1869, there were 109 women, an average of 5 per year, in other words, who did earn degrees from the University of Minnesota. And 6 of the 9 private colleges functioning in the state by the end of the century accepted women. But of these, only Hamline University in Carleton did have women in significant numbers. And there were 3 single-sex colleges for men, whereas there were none at all for women. Why the Sisters of St. Joseph took this upon themselves as a kind of ambition that was seemingly very hard to achieve, because they suffered from that panic and crash in the 1890s, just as Mariah Sanford did with their investments, was, I suppose, because they themselves were women and felt that they had a special obligation toward young women, and they did tend to think chiefly in terms of Catholic women in this context. Besides that, they had a very strong supporter in the Archdiocese, was by then the Archdiocese of St. Paul, in the figure of Archbishop Ireland, whose sister had been among the first six girls who had gone to St. Joseph Academy. And she and another sister and a first cousin of hers had been among the first, in fact, Ellen Ireland and her cousin were the first young women to enter the congregation of the Sisters of St. Joseph up in St. Paul. So he had very warm feelings toward women and their education. And opportunities that offered, that arose during the period for him to support the idea, eventuated finally in 1902 in his dedicating some money from the sale of one of his books to support the first building that became the College of St. Catherine. And at that time he gave a talk too, which later became quoted and was included in the catalog from the college from time to time. The quote is this: "Beyond a doubt, the sphere of women's activities has widened. Women's influence reaches much farther than ever before. And for such new conditions, she should be prepared by an intellectual training, higher and more thorough than has heretofore been necessary." Well, this was the context into which Annie McHugh, as I say, entered. She was very different from Mariah Sanford in her background, her origins, how she happened to get involved in the saga of the higher education of women in Minnesota. She was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1873, so she was quite a bit younger than Mariah Sanford, I mean older. Her parents were both Irish immigrants who had come to the United States from the route of Canada and, in the case of her mother, from the East Coast. She had an itinerant frontier childhood that involved a dozen moves in as many years, from Omaha up through Deadwood, South Dakota, and finally settling in Langdon, North Dakota. It was Mrs. McHugh, her mother, who insisted on an element of convent education for Annie after the family had finally settled in Langdon. Her father acceded to this request by taking her, first of all, to St. Joseph's Academy in St. Paul, and that's where the initial contact with the Sisters of St. Joseph occurred. And then, because by that time they had gotten a railroad through Langdon, North Dakota, and they had a connection which was very convenient with Winnipeg, she was sent up to the academy run by the Gray Nuns in Winnipeg. Annie emerged from her 4 years of boarding school. That was the extent of her formal education. She was in and out of quite a few little country schools before then. Accomplished in fine needlework, with an excellent command of French, and a lifetime love for art and music. She had also learned much more about her religion and carried away fond remembrances of friends, teachers, and favorite books, especially Steele's 14 Weeks in Botany and her geology textbook. She could also say with perfect truth what Martha Carey Thomas, a pioneering woman college president of Bryn Mawr, was to remark, referring to her own childhood in New England in the 1850s and 60s. Quote, "Throughout my childhood, I had never known a woman who had gone to college, nor seen anyone who had seen a woman who had gone to college." Unlike Carey Thomas, who probably also never saw a nun during her youth, Annie McHugh had been closely observant of sisters, both in St. Paul and in Winnipeg, during her most impressionable years. The result of these contacts and of the mysterious attractions which seemed to accompany any significant vocational choice was that she returned home the summer of 1889 with a request that she be allowed to join the Gray Nuns. This last outcome of convent education was unanticipated by her parents. Her father was not unalterably opposed, but persuaded her to stay home a year, she was then 16, until the children were a little older, especially since her mother was expecting their sixth child in November and needed Annie's help at home. It is a little contradictory to note that he thereupon took Annie off with him to the Constitutional Convention for the state of North Dakota, which he was a member, and then on to Yellowstone Park in September. So I don't know how much help she was back at home. I think the chief purpose of the trip was to give her a big thrill and distract her from her intentions. But the year's delay left Annie just as determined to enter the convent, a story repeated many times since then. The Gray Nuns, however, required a relatively large dowry of $700. For this reason, Annie made inquiries of the other sisters whom she had known at St. Paul, namely those of St. Joseph, and with a relatively small dowry, which they had at the time. She entered the community there in November 1890. Possessed of a better education than most of the other 22 young women, it's interesting to know there were 22 others who came that same November, September and November, to enter the community. She soon adapted herself to a routine which included both teaching the older novices and the academy girls, as well as the usual religious instructions and exercises which she was there to learn. The life was hard but satisfying, seemingly never in serious doubt about the rightness of her decision to join this group of women. Annie, who took the name of Sister Antonia, made a permanent commitment to the sisterhood through public vows in 1898. So it was this daughter of pioneers, and if we had time to elaborate on her life, you would see some of the features of pioneer life at the time, who at the age of 31 moved on with 26 other sisters, this is where you get this group effort again, from St. Joseph Academy to Durham Hall, as the building which the sisters had managed to construct was named, in order to open a new college in 1904. Classes attended by the 70 boarders who had transferred from St. Joseph Academy began the first week of January in 1905. Her life at this point becomes intertwined with what we might call institutional history. It really is both the evolution of her personal career and the growth of an institution or a college for women. It's difficult to determine exactly how the collegiate department of this Durham Hall, which was really in essence just the 70 boarders that came from St. Joseph Academy and were still high school students. There were six of them that were unclassified. That is, they were beyond high school, but they didn't exactly progress through college at that point either. It's difficult to say how it moved from non-existence to a full-fledged accredited college from 1906 to 1916. In other words, over the period of a single decade. There's no doubt, however, that Sister Antonia played a key role in the process. In anticipation of college teaching, she had begun work toward a bachelor degree at the University of Chicago by completing several correspondence courses in 1902 and 1903, snatching time for study during odd moments when not teaching, preparing to teach, or doing household chores. To the initial two courses by mail, she added others taken over four successive summer sessions from 1905 to 1908. Meanwhile, she continued to teach during the year itself back at the Durham Hall. Finally, attendance for a full year was arranged by the community. This enabled her to complete by December 1908 a Bachelor of Education and a Bachelor of Philosophy, the latter with honors. By August 1909, she had received a Master of Philosophy, and that was her final academic career. There are many interesting things about this period of Chicago, which was very influential on Sister Antonia, but in the interest of time, we'll pass over some of those details. She did emerge from Chicago, certainly, confirmed in her belief that women could accomplish great things. She reflected afterwards over some of the teachers she'd had there, including the women, with a new and exciting conception of what a college for women could and ought to be, a gathering of scholars, great men and women, so wholeheartedly dedicated to the spread of knowledge that they drew students into a mutual striving for learning. President Harper had come to the university during the first decade of its existence. The University of Chicago was only 10, 15 years old at this time. He had come there, he said, to do something new and different. There seemed no good reason to her why she, too, could not contribute something new to education in the Northwest. Hamlin Garland's picturesque exhortation, delivered at the first convocation that she attended at Chicago, was still fresh in her mind nearly 30 years later when she wrote some reminiscences. The first pioneers, he had said, were builders of the old trails of the West, only then giving way to railroads. Students at Chicago were to go forth as second pioneers, builders of the more permanent highways of the intellect. Once graduated from Chicago and back amid the rough realities of St. Paul, Sister Antonia was, as before, just one of the teachers rather than an official of the college. Still, no one took her lightly even then. Many years later, students recalled her homely dicta, oft repeated in the manner of all genuine folklore, "Energize yourself." Only horses were meant to hang their heads. The only thing wrong with that book is that the covers are too far apart. Self-pity is a destructive force. Fill your minds with great things, and there will be no room for trivialities. She who would be a woman must avoid mediocrity. prophets are seldom appreciated in their own country. It didn't occur to the sisters themselves to appoint Sister Antonia to some special official position in this growing college. But an outsider, in this case Archbishop Ireland, had picked her out a number of years before that as someone whom he thought could really build the college. He had sent her off to Chicago in 1905 with a letter of introduction to his good friend, President Harper of the University of Chicago. And it was owing to his influence that he persuaded his sister, Sister Seraphine Ireland, who was then superior of the community, to appoint Strantonia as academic dean of the college. Ireland continued to be referred to as the institution's founder. College catalogs designated the school as being conducted by the Sisters of St. Joseph and directed by His Grace, the Archbishop of St. Paul. And a paragraph on his founder's role was inserted following his death in 1918. But if Ireland was in some sense the founder, Sister Antonia McHugh was the builder. First as dean and then as president over a period of 23 years, she propelled the institution from virtually nothing to a fully accredited liberal arts college. Under her direction, the college very soon acquired a lay board of trustees and, in time, a distinguished faculty and an outstanding library. Six major buildings went up during the course of her administration. By the time of her retirement, the college had produced over 1,000 graduates, and last, but far from least, had merited a chapter of that exclusive National Honor Society, Phi Beta Kappa. Curriculum was the first area to reflect the new dean's energy and background. That's an interesting story in itself. Improvements in curriculum soon warranted inclusion of St. Catherine's on the accredited list of the University of Minnesota, but it didn't remove the problem of anonymity. The struggle to overcome this continued to be a challenge. Sister Antonia exhibited all the qualities of her future administrative style in a recruitment incident in 1911, following some summer contacts she had made in Omaha. A high school senior from Oberlin's preparatory school became interested in St. Catherine's through talking with Sister Antonia. But when she made inquiries through the University of Minnesota, the registrar, Mr. Pierce, replied that he had never heard of it. The dean's retaliation was direct, personal, and effective. She dashed over to the university and called the matter to the attention of her old Chicago mentor, Dr. Vincent, who was then president. Mr. Pierce thereafter remembered that St. Catherine's was a college located in St. Paul, Minnesota. Closely related to the curriculum developments and the entire accreditation process, as well as to the realization of that college vision Sister Antonia had acquired while at Chicago, was faculty development. By the time she became dean, two sisters in this group community to which she had joined had bachelor's degrees, and three others had master's degrees. Their teaching was supplemented by that of lecturers from the regular faculty of the university, St. Paul Seminary, and the College of St. Thomas, all men. Clearly, the boast made by the Reverend P.F. O'Brien on November 25th, 1906, had more the ring of prophecy than of accomplished fact. Father O'Brien, a redoubtable classicist and the first of a series of annual St. Catherine's Day addresses, declared somewhat prematurely, "In other places of education, it is the teachers who grasp the reputation. The ladies' colleges of the country, even Wellesley, Bryn Mawr, and Vassar, have to complete their efficiency by the adventitious aid of the sterner sex." It is the specific note of our Catholic colleges for women that the work is substantially done by members of their own sex. So we have to look to the male contingent of the time for pride in the work of the women. The five sisters who did have degrees covered a good spectrum of fields: English, Latin and Greek, history, and biology. Moreover, teachers of music had done advanced study, as had also the principal art instructor who had spent 2 years in Europe. Sister Antonia had been forced by increased administrative responsibilities to abandon her own pursuit of a doctorate. Instead, she turned her full attention to furthering the education of other younger sisters. In June of 1916, one of the college's 1914 graduates and three others had received their Master of Arts degree. By fall of 1917, four more had theirs. By 1920, an additional five, a pace which became commonplace in the community. Then during the decade from 1926 to 1936, 10 sisters earned Doctor of Philosophy degrees from Minnesota, Chicago, Columbia, Michigan, the Catholic University of America, Munich, Louvain. Two other sisters completed master's degrees at Oxford, while several others spent a year or more studying in England and France. This range of universities was indicative of the emancipated views held by Sister Antonia regarding the proper education of nuns. At the same time, distinguished lay professors and priests joined the faculty until by 1935 they constituted one-fifth of the total. Nearly nine-tenths of the total faculty were then women, of whom a large majority were religious of the Congregation of St. Joseph. Additional capital expenditures and the kind of plan Sister Antonia soon conceived for the education of the sisters in the building of a library involved insupportable burdens for a congregation whose members were paid $25 per month as parochial school teachers. Faced with the alternatives of curtailing her plans or seeking outside funding, the dean characteristically became the first women's college official in Minnesota to approach foundations for support. It was a task for which Sister Antonia was admirably well-fitted by reasons of physique and personality, with her erect carriage, large, clear gray eyes that seemed to reflect a deep penetration into any matter under consideration, a clear voice, and a complete command of words. She could make a very effective appeal. Somehow, she conveyed the impression of living in a world of wide horizons and high resolve. It seemed to those whom she approached, whether corporation executives or parents of a prospective student, that no school headed by her could be mediocre. In 1918, she persuaded the General Education Board of the Rockefeller Foundation, then headed by Dr. Vincent. Her friends were always a great help. She knew how to use men. She persuaded Dr. Vincent and the board to grant St. Catherine's $100,000, contingent upon the raising of a matching sum, double that amount. The total was to be used for endowment. This grant was realized in 1921 after an unusual direct contribution, the only one that ever occurred, by the Archdiocese of St. Paul to the college. The sum represented the share that Archbishop Dowling allotted to St. Catherine's from the education fund collected to memorialize Archbishop Ireland. It was very appropriate. In 1926, a second gift of $100,000 from the General Education Board facilitated construction of the science building, Mendel Hall. Library accessions were facilitated through grants of $25,000, $15,000 from the Carnegie Corporation. Strengthening of science and allied health areas was greatly aided in 1929 by a further endowment grant of $300,000 from the General Education Board. All in all, it was a record of foundation giving which compared very favorably with that achieved by the men college presidents among Sister Antonia's Minnesota peers. Her fundraising achievements completely eclipsed those of her female colleagues. The other sisters with whom Sister Antonia lived at St. Catherine shared with each step of the financial path as with other matters of the college. Their prayers were solicited as approach to this or that donor was anticipated. The various sisters from the house who accompanied her to New York or elsewhere returned to report the less official news of each trip. On one occasion, for example, she spilled biscuits from her voluminous purse in the hallowed boardrooms of the Rockefeller Foundation. Well, she had explained to startled onlookers, "You wonder if I'm stealing biscuits from the people of New York. But I am not. You know, our girls waste a great deal of bread. They like these hard water rolls, but they break them and eat only half of them, so I feel it is a great waste. We were invited out to dinner yesterday, and our hostess took us to the such-and-such hotel, and they served these size rolls with our dinner. It's exactly the size that I think we should have, so I am bringing them home so that our baker can make them that size, and thereby lessen our waste of bread." Shades of Mariah Sanford. Her account of just what she intended to do with the $300,000 which she was requesting from the board for health and science programs followed quite naturally and successfully from her explanation of why she was carrying biscuits in her purse. All these comings and goings did not appear to some critics to fit the picture of a woman of propriety, much less a religious. Fortunately, the Congregation of St. Joseph was capable of a broad tolerance. As that tireless chronicler of community affairs, it's the same Kate Hogan that was describing the curriculum at St. Joseph Academy who wrote this reminiscence in 1921. "It takes all people to make a world, and it takes all kinds of people to do the different phases of work in the community." Letters from Europe in the spring of 1932 afford rare glimpses into her ordinary mode of action when at home and too busy to write much of anything. From Rome in April of 1932, she wrote, "I saw in the paper this morning that the Insull Company is in bad straits. I'm mightily glad I did not give up my address and bonds when we were advised to." Again from Paris, "I'm glad Robert is getting that matter settled about the Wells-Dickey loan. I'm so mad at them and Mr. Lilly. However, I can wait. I may yet be able to give RCL a good whack, and I shall not feel sorry. One is prepared to credit the rumor that the banker alluded to in the Paris letter was afraid of only one woman and not his wife. And to believe that the contractor who said, after completing the campus church, that he believed he had satisfied Sister Antonia, which I was told could not be done. Sister Antonia was a woman, the contractor went on to say, who knew what she wanted and was pleased when she got a real job. Whether it was the building of a college or the acquiring of great laurels for the college, Sister Antonia did have an amazing sense of what she wanted and generally did get the job done. Acquisition of a chapter of Phi Beta Kappa in 1937 proved the point, as few other accomplishments did. At the time she became dean, only two other Minnesota institutions, the University and Carleton College, had persuaded the country's most venerable and prestigious honor society to grant them chapters. Keep in mind that the college was only accredited in 1916. Her first application for Phi Beta Kappa was made in 1921. Despite the good offices of President Burton of Michigan, Wallace Buttrick from Carnegie, and her old Chicago friends Vincent and Angel, she had to abandon the 1921 effort for lack of sufficient backers. There, the matter rested until the mid-1930s, when she entrusted the responsibility for a Phi Beta Kappa review to Sister Jean-Marie Bonnet, one of the most intellectually gifted alumni the college had produced. Back at St. Catharines, a full decade after completing doctoral studies at the University of Louvain in Belgium, Sister Jean-Marie drew on her expertise in psychology and education and on the cumulative records of the college to produce a 138-page report which displayed to full advantage the strengths of the young institution. This she followed up with an appointment in New York with Dr. Schreimer, then president of Phi Beta Kappa, to refute rumored suspicions that Catholic colleges, hitherto totally unrepresented in the society, curtailed academic freedom or suffered from inbreeding of faculty. The persuasiveness of Sister Jean-Marie's personal intervention, together with the cogency of her report, smoothed the way for a December 1936 on-site review. This culminated in a positive United Chapters vote early the next year. The Gamma Chapter of Minnesota was installed shortly thereafter. Sadly enough, news of the coveted Phi Beta Kappa affiliation came on the heels of Sister Antonia's retirement from the presidency after she suffered a stroke in February of 1936. Previous bouts of ill health had given warning, yet no one, least of all herself, fully anticipated the abrupt curtailment of her capacity for administrative responsibility. At the peak of her active career, Sister Antonia had brought to the institution the special luster of her own accomplishments. Invitational participation in the White House Conference on Child Health and Protection in 1930, papal honors in the form of the Pro Ecclesiae Pontificic Decoration in 1931, presidency of the Minnesota Association of Colleges, chairmanship of the National Catholic Educational Association Conferences of College for Women, executive positions in the American Association of Colleges, an honorary doctorate from the University of Minnesota in 1936, and a University of Chicago Distinguished Alumni Citation in 1943. The college itself and the women whose lives it affected were, to be sure, Sister Antonia's most tangible achievement and legacy to Minnesota. For many, Sister Antonia's Wednesday morning assembly talks epitomized these collegiate goals and experiences described in a letter from an alumna. Character training, or the building of life. Who could ever forget her urging us to chisel our characters? To accomplish hard things, to be women of good sense. She taught us that the ideal of sound, strong Catholic womanhood is big, simple, noble, and practicable. Through some personal magic all her own, she had infused into the college the practicality, the drive of the Minnesota Midwest pioneer, an attitude which I think is captured in a remark that she made to Sister St. Helene, another of her confreres back home, apropos of the English ladies who had feted her during a stay in Rome, quote, "They have many good qualities, but they are not doing a blessed thing for anyone." After her retirement, Sister Antonia continued to take a keen interest and pleasure in the welfare of the college and in the accomplishments and simple personal concerns of its alumni. She received numerous visitors in her quarters in Whitby Hall, sometimes relatives or sisters stopping by to borrow books from her private collection or to chat about the affairs of the day. The unaccustomed leisure forced upon her by physical weakness gave her time to reflect on the turning points of her life. Choice of the religious life was one of these, a decision which she did not regret, even though living it out had not been easy. To her niece, she confided that poverty is nothing. And when we look at Mariah Sanford's, I can agree. Chastity is nothing, but obedience. Looking back on her attendance at the University of Chicago in place of Harvard, where she had wanted to go, she concluded that limitations are our greatest blessings. It was a relief to be spared the constant worries of college building. Still, she missed the matching of wits and challenges the job had entailed, and, as she called it, the luxury of losing her temper. Certain less ingratiating character traits were softened and mitigated when Sister Antonia removed herself from office. A natural impatience with ineptitude, or even with the prudent reservations of others called upon to implement policies, such nonsense, don't be a baby, yielded to greater tolerance. That was one of her favorite sayings. She had made more than a few enemies over the span of a hard-hitting and long administrative career. You know, remarked one of her friends at the time, she'd call people jackasses if they did this or that, or objected to this or that. Her last years now saw a reconciliation to many of these people. Finally, the end came with another stroke, gradual loss of speech and death, all mercifully within the space of 1 week, October 4th to 11th, 1944. She had lived as a sister of St. Joseph for 54 years, all of them in the state of Minnesota, laboring zealously to educate women. Her sisters in religion and a large crowd of relatives, friends, faculty, and students laid her body to rest in Calvary Cemetery and returned their separate ways to resume their daily occupations. For some, it seemed impossible to visualize St. Catherine College without Sister Antonia. To me, had written an alumna in 1936, the St. Joseph community and St. Catherine's has meant you. But her work was bigger than herself and outlasted her in the lives of those she knew and affected so deeply, in the college she founded, and in the religious community within which she realized her genius.
Let's stand up for 5 minutes before we hear the other two speaking. Stretch.
Ada Louise Comstock's life touched on both Mariah Sanford's and Sister Antonia's. She was hired into the department of which Mariah Sanford was the chairman, and she received an, she was a...
chairperson.
Remember what I said last week about how we're all overcome by this bad use of man, woman words. You see, you're all sensitized now. Hoist on my own petard. She was a chair, Mariah Sanford would have said chairman, I think. Ada Comstock certainly would have. At any rate, she also was a contemporary of Sister Antonia's, and she received an honorary degree from the University of Minnesota at the same commencement that Sister Antonia did. So their lives all touched. But Ada Louise Comstock was a very different person, and she had a very different kind of life from either of the other two women. Her father, her family, was one of wealth and prominence in Minnesota. They were a wealthy Moorhead family. Her father was early blessed in his career with a successful law practice and some very valuable real estate that came about as the result of his friendship with James J. Hill. And he was able to provide for his family the expansiveness, the luxury, the affluence that allowed them to develop their vigor. And his elder daughter, Ada, took advantage of it to the hilt. Her life was also different because her father played so much of a role in it. He encouraged her from the time she was very little to develop her intellectual gifts. He thought she was perfect. He brought her books from St. Paul. He encouraged her to read out loud, and he always took it for granted that she would go to college. Her formal education was quite extensive for a woman of that time. She began at the University of Minnesota her first 2 years because her father thought that she was too young. She was only 15. To go far away to school. And then after the first 2 years, she transferred to Smith, where she had to go 3 years because not all of her credits at the university would transfer. She graduated from Smith in 1897 and came back home because her father thought that his children ought to be able to take care of themselves, and a Smith education wasn't going to help her do that. So she went to the Moorhead State Normal School. where she entered the second year of the advanced teaching program, got a teaching certificate, and then she went off to Columbia University, where she got a master's degree. Mind you, this was in 1898, and that was quite an extraordinary thing for a woman to do. She got a master's degree in English, History, and Education, studying with quite a prominent education faculty there. So in 1899, she was finished with her education, except later on when she was at the university, she spent a brief time at the Sorbonne studying there. 1899, she returned to Minnesota, and she was looking for a job. She was endued with enormous energy, vigor. She was tall. She had a beautifully cultured, resonant voice with which she could captivate audiences and did from the time she was a child. And she had a spirit that was still full of humor and vigor. Some of these childhood stories transferred over into her early career, but later they became modified more into pure vigor and the stately, commanding presence that she took with her into what became largely an administrative career. In that respect, she differed from Sister Antonia and Mariah Sanford also. They stayed in Minnesota for the most part in their careers, but Ada soon moved east rather than Mariah, who moved west. Ada was successively the first dean of women at the University of Minnesota, the first dean at Smith College, and finally the first full-time president of Radcliffe, where she retired in 1943 after 20 years of service. But in 1899, this was all still a glimmer, if a vigorous glimmer, in her eye, and she returned to Minnesota to look for a job. A friend of her father's, who was, among other things, a member of the Board of Regents at the University of Minnesota, came to her rescue. He thought there must be something at the university she could do. After all, she'd had enough education. And raised the issue with its president, Cyrus Northrop. There was no money left with which to make additional faculty appointments. But finally, President Northrop was persuaded to give her a fellowship that would pay $25 a month, this after a master's degree at Columbia. This would do, the Regents thought, because her father had enough money to clothe her. So Ada Comstock was appointed as an assistant in the Department of Rhetoric. In 1900, however, she was appointed to the faculty at the rank of instructor. Her promotion to assistant professor took effect while she was studying at the Sorbonne in the academic year 1904-1905. Teaching freshmen how to write was the most serious academic challenge she had ever had. During the first year or two, she devoted herself to her more interesting students. These, she thought, were often the agriculture students, and she thought it might be because they came to the task of writing with interesting things to talk about. It wasn't long, however, before she tried to cope with the situation as a whole. Those of you who've tried to teach writing know what that means. It had been relatively easy to draw male scoffers out of the back row and closer to her desk. But it was far from easy to understand and correct the writing deficiencies of significant numbers of students. In her search for effective teaching methods, her pedagogy was sometimes brutal. She once asked a student to read his theme to the class so they might have a bad example for discussion. When they had exhausted themselves of criticism, he turned to her on the verge of tears and said, "Don't ever do that to me again." She was somewhat taken aback as she told the story later, but she really wasn't persuaded that it had been a bad idea. Eventually, she came to some conclusions about this English program in writing. She didn't care if students could recite contemporary rules of composition or not, as long as their writing reflected knowledge of them. What she wanted was clear, fluent, unaffected style. She found fault gently, tactfully, but she found it in many places. Poor speech habits at home, too much emphasis on composition as a fine art, and overworked public school teachers were all part of the problem. The solution, she thought, was not to be found in one academic department, but in the entire educational system. It was characteristic of the way she approached a problem that she should reach beyond particulars to a larger view of it. At the same time, she was observing women students and their relationship to the university. There were more on campus than when she had been a student, but their circumstances were not much different. And when she had been a student, the university was really quite inhospitable to students. They simply weren't part of the corporate body of the university at all. They were just sort of permitted to come there. The effort of women for higher education was regarded as a more or less humorous thing. She went once to see the editor-in-chief of one of the Minneapolis newspapers to ask him to refer to women students by some other term than co-eds and to write about their activities in a way that was not facetious. He only laughed at her. But the university did not laugh at her. If nothing else, it was agreed that the growing number of females on the campus needed to be supervised. In 1907, Ada Comstock was promoted to the rank of professor and appointed the first dean of women at the University of Minnesota. The Moorhead Daily News talked proudly about her election by the Regents and about the 1,000 students who had signed a petition on her behalf. It was, the editors thought, a striking recognition of a broadly cultured, dignified, and gracious young womanhood. The new dean set out immediately to improve the quality of university life for women students. With what we know now about the responsibilities of the offices of dean of students, the kinds of things that are being done with student life on campus, it's hard for us to realize what a controversial, what an unusual thing this was for any dean, not just a dean of women, to do, to take an interest in the students' lives, in their living conditions. She helped them organize a cap and gown society for the purposes of promoting a spirit of sociability. She arranged a series of afternoon teas for the same purpose. She encouraged and sponsored women's organizations of all kinds. Then she turned to the matter of living conditions. She personally visited boarding houses located near the university to give them an opportunity to be listed as university-approved residences for women. She asked only that the boarding house be limited to female boarders and that a special room for callers be provided. The effect of employment on academic performance also fell under her scrutiny. A study of university women who were self-supporting revealed that their grades were as good as those who were not self-supporting. Their problems subsequently became a concern of her office. During Christmas recess of the academic year 1911-1912, the dean herself went looking for jobs for university women in Minneapolis and St. Paul. The most tangible accomplishment of the Comstock administration, however, was the funding and raising of Shevlin Hall. It had been clear to the dean for a long time that the mice-infested ladies' parlor in the main building was a symbol of an environment that was inadequate, even detrimental to the needs of women. She argued persistently that intellectual attainment was inseparable from physical well-being and that the university was responsible for both. When she took a request for a women's building to President Northrop, only to be told that there was a greater need for a new chemistry building, she sat and wept. The money she needed was donated shortly thereafter. The dedication of Shevlin Hall marked a new era for women at the University of Minnesota. Its meeting rooms, resting parlors, and eating facilities would give women a place of privacy where they could gather their resources. Energy that had been used to survive could finally be given to education. The nomadic life for women students at the university was beginning to be over. The author of these changes had blossomed herself. Pioneering as a dean agreed with her. Ada always liked organizing and doing something new. She liked taking a new job, a first of its kind, and building it. In 1910, she had become president of a newly organized association of deans of women. The association was a triumphal statement that universities had finally acknowledged the presence of women in higher education. It was also an announcement that deans of women were not local caretakers, but permanent and professional parts of the educational establishment. For Ada Comstock, it was a sign of progress. Then she discovered that she was presiding over a job she'd completed. The University of Minnesota was a growing institution. The administration of the new president, George Vincent, had been exciting and instructive. Moreover, she was something of a campus belle and caught up in a whirl of social invitations. None of it overcame the fact that she was getting bored. It was inevitable that she should be attracted by an invitation from Smith College to become its dean. She would have opportunities at Smith to teach and advise young women that were unavailable at a coeducational institution. Besides, it was a new job, a first of its kind. The class of 1897, which was her class at Smith, turned out for its 15th reunion and the commencement of 1912 in exuberant force. They were ecstatic about Ada's appointment and beleaguered her lovingly throughout the festivities. She was asked to sit on the platform. They threw daisies at her. At intervals, they chanted, "Sing, sing, sing to Ada Comstock, 97's Dean of Smith, for we're proud to own the college which displays the taste and knowledge to make 97's Ada Dean of Smith." Ada ran herself ragged in a flush of excitement. She drank great quantities of congratulatory champagne, went on picnics, and sat up in midnight conversations. She also met with trustees, carried the standard for her class, and spoke at commencement. When it was over, she went to bed with a cold. She rose to make a complete appraisal of student life at Smith. It was anticipated that the dean of the college would be interested in academic standards and educational philosophy. But no one was quite prepared for her interest in the living conditions, in the students' lives. Her first project was to evaluate all student housing. Then she tried to find out what it cost a student to come to Smith. After a survey of student expense journals that had been especially kept for her review, she was able to offer the information that a student could manage for $400 a year and meet all of her needs for $750 a year. Within 5 years, she had taken steps to expand housing available on campus, had proposed new plans for regulating living units, and had struggled for the new Elizabeth Mason Infirmary. All of these activities were in accord with her conviction that education had an effect, must have an effect, on the mind and the body together in order to have an effect on the total educational experience. Since Smith did not need to be convinced that it was appropriate to educate women, the dean could turn her attention at once to a refinement of educational objectives. One of the most important, she thought, should be to inculcate in young women a respect for themselves. She took many occasions to describe what she meant by self-respect. The cumulative definition was quite demanding. The self-respecting woman would not ever wish to be conspicuous. She hated flappers. And would follow fashion with moderation. She would speak in a beautiful and simple way, expressing thoughts of a lofty nature. Above all, she would not follow blindly the behests of the mob or accept ideas ready-made. Out of context, these ideas might seem like dated moral etiquette for the socially favored. But 60 years ago, they were an assertion of integrity and autonomy on behalf of every woman. One of the last things she said to the class of 1922 was, "If you sufficiently respect yourselves, if you sufficiently value the life given you to live, I have faith to believe that your answers will be more nearly right than ours have been." She was expressing her confidence in the value of their individuality and begging them to share it with her. One tangible aspect of self-respect was knowing how to employ oneself. There were many ways an educated woman might do that without venturing out of woman's traditional sphere. Ada Comstock always thought the college had a responsibility to acquaint women with a full range of potentials. Early in her career at Smith, she wrote a pamphlet listing the vocations available to college women. It suggested everything from commercial photography to municipal research. Professions such as law and pharmacy were excluded only because to her they seemed self-evident. A central objective of education, as she saw it, was to direct the average woman, not endowed with extraordinary energy or cleverness, to success. Above all, a college education should inspire a woman to take her part in shaping the world. The First World War gave her an opportunity to talk about the responsibilities of women at a time of crisis. She knew that a war causes a nation to set aside domestic squabbles for the sake of a united front, and she wholeheartedly approved of that. But she also knew what that might mean for concerns vital to women. People would be called to unselfishness and sacrifice in the name of the war effort. And in the process, the arguments advanced on behalf of a new role for women would be silenced. In the face of this, she urged women to make their contributions to their country by dispassionate thinking, mental development, and continuing aspiration. They had a job to do in a world that demanded more of them than the temporary comforts they might be able to offer. Educated women active in the world were, in fact, associating under Ada Comstock's leadership. She became the first president of the American Association of University Women in 1921. One of this organization's most ambitious projects in its early years, many of you may know this, was sponsoring the International Federation of University Women. Hopes for the federation were high. Educated women from several participating countries saw it as a vehicle for encouraging education among women and thereby increasing amity among nations. Ada returned from a Federation Council meeting in London in 1921 full of enthusiasm. Her enthusiasm was sustained by the second biennial meeting in Paris in the following year. She saw a near future in which the quality of education for women would be improved and a mutual understanding would flourish. This achievement among women, she felt certain, would have a positive influence on international affairs. A world war had not altered her belief that peace and cooperation among nations were logical possibilities. In these strange days, she wrote, idealism has come to be the only practical cure for the very concrete ills which the world is suffering. Ada Comstock's years of deaning at Smith are recorded in superlatives and recalled with devotion. Her achievements for the college are almost numberless. So also were her contributions to the well-being of those with whom she came in contact. She was a gentlewoman of the sort she most admired, giving praise without clamor and encouragement without patronage. She had a gift for warmth and responded to those who offered it, but she never permitted intimacy. Even her most trusted secretary did not know how unhappy she had been with her relationship to the college during the time between President Burton's departure and the arrival of William Allen Nielsen to the same office, because although the trustees had given her full responsibility for all the duties of the presidency, they had refused to give her the title of acting president. She was wounded and humiliated, and she never forgot it till the day she died. She never stopped feeling it was an insult, and she confessed to one of her old friends that when she went home and wept buckets. Her relationship with President Nielsen, despite this, became deep and affectionate, and they worked together inseparably for many years. The time came again, as it inevitably did for Ada, when a new job challenged her away from a work she had completed. She never knew whose idea it was that she should be interviewed for the presidency of Radcliffe College, but it took her only a fortnight to accept the offer. Her decision to leave Smith brought gestures of esteem from all sides. The faculty issued a statement expressing a deep sense of official and personal loss, as well as its affection and admiration. The students collected $600 to be placed in her name at the bookstore of her choice. The loyal class of 1897 presented Smith with a portrait of Ada Louise Comstock as their 25th reunion gift. William Allen Nielsen saved his farewell for her inauguration. Ada Louise Comstock was inaugurated as the first full-time president of Radcliffe College on Saturday, October 20th, 1923. The ceremony was simple and impressive. The inaugural speeches went elegantly to the heart of most of the pending issues. Marion Edwards Park, president of Bryn Mawr, spoke confidently of Radcliffe's potential and Ada Comstock's endurance. William Allen Nielsen took advantage of the outspokenness permitted a bereft president. He warned the Radcliffe associates and the Harvard Corporation that everyone in the academic community was watching the fortunes of Radcliffe, so many of which rested in their hands. The same was true of their new president, whom, he thought, should be displaced only by greater opportunity. His concluding remark was addressed to Ada herself. If you find this household into which you have been taken intolerable, you can always come home. The laughter indicated that his gentle humor had gone straight to the mark. President Lowell of Harvard was mild and gracious. Of course, President Comstock would have his help whenever she needed it. The new president rose to a standing ovation. She spoke of academic standards, admissions, and the inadequacy of fragmented education. She offered the opinion that the student had not sufficiently entered into the reckoning in educational planning. Everything she said was spoken to colleagues or patrons with whom she assumed a body of shared ideals. There was universal agreement, she was sure, that education is the only means of relief in a confused world, and that there is a demand for men and women who have the capacity, the training, and the will to think. She thus offered the essence of her educational idealism without thrusting anything radical upon her new colleagues. She was entering the arena with quiet reasonableness. The Radcliffe Quarterly was jubilant. Under such leadership, it wrote, we may feel a deep sense of security with high hopes of the future of our college. The challenge that faced President Comstock was not a casual one. Radcliffe may have had potential, but it had distinct problems. It lacked resident faculty of its own, its facilities were undeveloped, and its finances were in a tangle. It needed Harvard. But association between Harvard and Radcliffe was not something that could be taken for granted. Abbot Lawrence Lowell, the president of Harvard, was determined to cut the Radcliffe parasite off from Harvard. As far as he was concerned, the invitational lectures that the Harvard faculty gave at Radcliffe were sapping their academic strength. Beyond that, he thought that the Radcliffe idea was just all out of proportion and a nuisance to serious academic endeavor. He also said on one occasion that he thought no woman, not even the president of Radcliffe, was capable or should deserve a salary of $3,000 a year. Serious academic endeavor was exactly what Ada Comstock had in mind, and she proceeded toward it from several directions. She charmed the members of the Harvard Corporation at Greenleaf House, which was the residence of the Radcliffe president, with a mixture of educational philosophy and kidney pie. She made it her business to know when a Harvard faculty member was doing something well, and then engaged his interest in the fun to be had from sharing it with Radcliffe students. The tutoring system used at Harvard was adapted for Radcliffe. After a few years, special tutoring rooms were organized and a tutorial secretary was appointed. The president had high hopes that the tutorial system might develop in the young American the thoughtfulness, thoroughness, and self-reliance which constitute independent citizenship in the intellectual world. She also thought that it might start women tutors on the road toward academic careers. Then she began to talk about the scholarly life and critical research among women and what part Radcliffe might play in enhancing them. The key to Radcliffe's permanence had two aspects. One was its continuing association with Harvard. The other was its independent strength. President Comstock's policies emphasized one or the other in delicate balance throughout most of her administration. She had to stay in contact with Harvard. She needed Harvard, but she had to make Radcliffe independent for survival. Once she'd attracted the Harvard faculty, she had turned her attention to things that belonged to Radcliffe. Early in the 20s, she invited four Boston and Cambridge clergymen to serve as college chaplains by conducting weekly services of morning prayer at Agassiz House. That was the administration building at Radcliffe. She called for the formulation of a building program, indicated her own wish for a special building for graduate students, and created a new Department of Health Education. It was during this period that she brought Radcliffe into association with six other women's colleges to consider matters of mutual concern. It wasn't until the late 20s that she tried to initiate a more formal claim to the Harvard faculty. She pointed out to her trustees that instruction at Radcliffe was an addition to a Harvard faculty member's regular program, and as such, most likely to be sacrificed in the event of professional and academic pressures upon the individual. So the solution would be joint appointments, secured by endowment monies from Radcliffe. She was careful to add, however, that she believed that the foundation upon which Radcliffe rested was Harvard instruction. It would always be Radcliffe's policy, she promised, to preserve the relationship with Harvard which affords the foundation. Her reputation as an educator drew the president of Radcliffe outside the academic community in 1929. In that year, President Herbert Hoover appointed her to the National Commission on Law Observance and Enforcement. The Wickersham Commission, as the newspapers called it, was charged with analyzing the problems of law enforcement with particular attention to the 18th Amendment. That was prohibition, as you recall. The report was to recommend remedial action at the state and local levels. When Ada Comstock, the only woman on the 11-member commission, was interviewed about her assignment, all she would say was that there is an interesting piece of work to be done, and I'm glad to have a part in it. When the commission finally issued its report in 1931, she was listed among the five who favored modification of the 18th Amendment. Reminded of her work on the commission many years later, she said, "I never had more fun." In the autumn of 1931, she took a three-month leave of absence to attend a meeting in Shanghai of the Institute of Pacific Relations, to which she was appointed for the third time as a delegate. The idea of the institute was to conduct a study of the conditions of the Pacific peoples with a view to the improvement of their mutual relations. Its procedures involved, quote, a continuous process of discussion supported by intensive research. The institute had no program of action and passed no resolutions, nor were its delegates representatives of governments or organizations. Presiding over the Shanghai meeting was a philosopher. If such a meeting could take place with civility and goodwill right after the clash between China and Japan and Manchuria, it must mean that the world could be altered through cooperation to be a better place. There must be such a thing as progress. And then there was the crash of 1929. But it didn't paralyze Radcliffe as it had many institutions. In fact, Radcliffe didn't even have a deficit. The 30s were years of new plans and ambitious projects. The administration now included a dean of the graduate school and a dean of undergraduate instruction. An admissions program was initiated to attract students from all over the country who were, quote, capable of distinguished achievement. New classroom buildings appeared and steps were taken to improve student housing. The academic program was also expanding. Radcliffe followed Harvard in offering a doctorate in American civilization. It also offered preparation for certification in secondary school teaching and a training course in personnel administration. The appointment bureau was revitalized by a new director to find jobs for Radcliffe graduates in a depression economy. Radcliffe had gained enough strength by the late 30s to make a major commitment practicable. In the spring of 1937, the president's report to the trustees described a $4 million fund drive for expansion of endowment, fellowships, and facilities. It was a symbol of success, confidence, and permanence. It was also a staggering responsibility. While the Boston newspapers were singing compliments to Radcliffe's president, she was writing to her brother, "Sometimes the thought of it makes me feel like one of those witches whom they killed by heaping stones on them." About the same time, Radcliffe flourished her independent mind in the matter of instruction. A graduate course offered in music by the visiting lecturer, Mademoiselle Nadia Boulanger, was announced with the note that Radcliffe would accept any properly qualified Harvard student. It was, after all, the time-honored vocabulary with which Radcliffe students had been addressed by Harvard. The cumulative effect was too much for the Harvard administration, and a committee of eight was assembled to study the relationship between Harvard and Radcliffe. Among its recommendations was the limitation of teaching by the Harvard faculty at Radcliffe. It was a blow to a thriving institution, but President Comstock calmly told her trustees that whatever the difficulties of adjustment may be, nothing would be more short-sighted than for Radcliffe to quarrel with any arrangement short of categorical prohibition, which in the long run promises to strengthen the Harvard faculty and increase its effectiveness. Meanwhile, she wrote about the assured future of the coordinate college, which she was trying to build Radcliffe into being. Harvard might be chafing against Radcliffe's presence, but it could not rid itself of an association for mutual advantage in which Ada Comstock believed. The deepening of conflict in Europe a second time toward the Second World War displaced some of Ada's idealism and made room for an unusual kind of melancholy. Her outlook was generally darkened by this fresh indication of how little progress had been made in the world. She began to reflect, as she had during World War I, about what a new world would mean for women. She was convinced that the threat to democracy offered by totalitarian governments was doubly a threat to women. Measures to limit employment of married women were reminiscent to her of the attitudes toward women in fascist countries, and she advised vigilance. A deficit at Radcliffe, the loss of her new dean, and the preparation for war in Boston added to her bleak state of mind. When war finally came, she added her efforts to the task at hand. She made speeches, organized the Cambridge Salvage Committee, and worked with Women's Division of the Cambridge Committee on Public Safety. War meant many things for Radcliffe. It drew off members of the faculty at Harvard, and many women were appointed in their places. Women were admitted to graduate classes at Harvard in order to fill them. Summer courses were introduced in order to accelerate degree programs, and both men and women were admitted to them. The pressures of empty classrooms brought the two institutions to a point of cooperation that they had never before achieved. Ada Comstock had spent years matching Radcliffe with Harvard in quality and accomplishment. National crisis did the rest. Harvard was persuaded to accept classroom coeducation in 1943. In her annual report to the trustees, the president of Radcliffe announced that the anomalous arrangement between Radcliffe and Harvard becomes a contract of specific rights and obligations. Departments are now charged with the duty of providing Radcliffe with instruction adequate to attain the degree. This was the spring of her retirement, and she had completed the work she had come to do. Ada Comstock retired from Radcliffe at the end of an era. Her leadership had brought the institution to maturity and distinction. The tributes to her were eloquent, sad, and intimate. The newspapers spoke of a grievous loss. President Nielsen spoke of her in the Quarterly. Gifts were made to her, and she departed amid great sadness and great reverence. If we were to try to summarize in one statement what Ada Comstock did for women in higher education, it would be appropriate to say that she contributed as much as any other woman in American higher education at the time to reshaping the academic structure so that women were actually a part of it and not just attending upon it. She created a new office at the University of Minnesota. She created a new deanship at Smith. She created a full-time presidency at Radcliffe. She solidified the relationship between Radcliffe and Harvard. She made it possible for women to be part of the educational establishment. A postscript is appropriate here, and it's one I think that you'll find of special interest. Ada Comstock retired from Radcliffe in the spring of 1943 when she was 67. And a few days later, the Radcliffe community was electrified to learn that she had been married in the living room of Greenleaf House. For many years, she had been attended upon by suitors. At first, they were young men at the University of Minnesota, one to whom she was engaged, but managed to abandon the liaison for a professional career. Others followed her through her life in attendance. Still others lost their wives along the way and came back to her. At one point in her career, and mind you, this is something Ada Comstock would never discuss in such a forum. But I must depart from her style at this point, get into more of my own. At one point, she was being courted. This was in her early 60s. By a man by the name of George Bacon, who was a wealthy industrialist in New York and was sure that she was going to marry him. There was no doubt in his mind that he was going to marry. He was a man accustomed to having whatever he wanted. He used to go downtown Boston and order negligees sent over to Greenleaf House, and he would say in a loud voice, "Just charge it to my account and send it to the president of Radcliffe." He would order cases of champagne and a great basket full of flowers and have them delivered. On occasion, he came to her home over the weekend as a house guest, and she tried to keep him indoors. But she left the house temporarily to do something in the administration building, and he wandered out into the backyard in his bathing trunks and struck up conversations with the co-eds through the hedge. Then there was William Allen Nielsen, the president emeritus of Smith, whose wife had died, who was also interested in the president of Radcliffe. And there was an old suitor, Wallace Notstein, whom she had known since she was at the University of Minnesota and had since become a professor of history at Yale. Well, a few years before her retirement, she assembled the three of them, and the four of them went together for a trip to Europe. She saw no reason why they couldn't enjoy one another's company. But in 1943, at the age of 67, and much to the astonishment of George Bacon, she announced her marriage to Wallace Notstein. Their long acquaintance had created no particular assumption on his behalf, and everyone was astonished. Not only her graduate dean, even her graduate dean. She maintained a private silence almost to the day itself, and then she wrote to an old friend who had once been the undergraduate dean at Radcliffe, "I'm going to New Haven to be a faculty wife. I hope you don't think it too absurd or risky." Retirement was a misnomer for her married state. She was on the board of trustees for Smith, was working on plans for the Graduate Center at Radcliffe, and was inundated by educational committee work. In her 70th year, she complained especially of January, a month filled with trips in connection with the Smith Board of Trustees, the China College for Women, and the Institute for Pacific Relations. In February of 1949, she delivered a 75th anniversary address at Smith. In 1959, at the age of 82, she enraptured an audience at the inauguration of President Thomas Mendenhall of Smith. Long after her departure from Radcliffe, she received honorary degrees from both Harvard and Oxford. She certainly appeared to be living in accord with an opinion she had expressed long before it had anything to do with her. "I cannot see why writing, painting, laboratory research, or any other valuable contribution to life and living need of necessity be stopped by marriage." Marriage did, however, introduce significant new dimensions to her life. One was a completely different sphere, although still an academic one, in the Yale community at New Haven. Another one was the endless administration of a two-career household. It's amazing how petulant one can sound at 75 after several years of calm university administration. While the Sterling Professor Emeritus of History at Yale feverishly wrote up his research, his wife was dealing with a long procession of cooks, maids, and furnace and fence repairmen. Domestic service was far from infallible, and a successful social occasion frequently required a deft balance of confusion in the dining room with tact and good conversation after dinner. She greeted these trivia of life with as much incredulity as she did impatience. Writing to an old friend, she remarked, "Someday we must talk about the need for a woman with a home and husband." This was at the age of 80. "Of some quiet, sustained, interesting piece of work, which she can retreat into and thereby keep a thread of continuity in her life. Also, I should like to write a platform for professional women which would induce them to relieve themselves of the small duties of living which men disregard so readily. I'm convinced that the superior achievement of men," this from the former president of Radcliffe, "is due in part to their refusals, right and necessary, to be distracted by concern for clothes, foods, housekeeping, bill paying, and all the rest. Why can't we clear the decks?" It wasn't really a complaint, just an observation. Ada Comstock Notstein died early in the morning of December 12, 1973. Her last words were of her father. The newspapers carried all the facts about her. She had received 14 honorary degrees and had three residence halls named after her. The Radcliffe College Alumni Fund endowed a Radcliffe scholarship in her honor. She had received the Radcliffe Founders Award and had as the chief architect of the greatness of the college. Rockford College had given her its Jane Addams Medal, and Ida M. Tarbell had cited her as one of the foremost women in the United States. Her friends spoke in memorial of her gifts and her graces. They recalled her achievements at Smith and Radcliffe, her integrity, wisdom, charm, courage. For many, she was a personified ideal. Some people have told me they thought that she was nothing less than a goddess. I think she would have counted her life and her career a success if we think of her simply as a predecessor.